This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Hi, everyone, and thanks for joining us. My name is Trista Kelly. I'm the features editor at Financial News, and welcome to Barron's Live, the Financial News edition. And I'm pleased today to welcome Carson Block. He's the Chief Investment Officer of Muddy Waters Capital. Thanks, Carson, for being here with us today.
Well, thank you, Trista.
It's hard to introduce Carson. I've known him for a really long time. To a lot of people, and with the people I talk to and the people we write for, he doesn't really need an introduction. He's one of the most famous faces when it comes to short selling. And the CEO of Muddy Waters Capital, as I said, is a hedge fund that specializes in short selling stocks. And he bets that they'll go down, basically, usually after Carson and his analysts say they found suspicious or all out fraudulent trading activity. Carson's also the founder of Zeros TV, an online channel for short selling related content. And he's appeared in books, documentaries, and is a staple on financial TV talking about short selling. And he shot to fame in 2011, back when I covered him, with a short on Sinoforest, a company that eventually delisted under fraudulent allegations. And he's had dozens, if not more than dozens, notable wins since. I'll get right into it. I know that we have a lot of questions. There's a lot of fans, it seems, in the audience. So basically, you started shorting more than a decade ago in China, and then you've had a research firm. I haven't caught up with you in a really long time, a hedge fund, a TV channel. How's it going?
Okay. Good days and bad days. There's been a lot that's gone on in the short selling world since I started. I mean, I'd say a lot of really death of short sellers, and we don't run a lot of money. We can't run a lot of money if we really want to stay in business. And, you know, we're just looking to, I mean, we've basically, you know, we've focused for the past, I don't know, 10, 11 years on activist short selling. And we're finally at a point now where we're broadening out a little bit, and doing some things that are, you know, more sophisticated with respect to activist short selling, but it's a harder environment than it ever was before, you know, especially coming out of COVID and the, you know, once again, the emergency monetary policies that I don't know are going to end in, you know, our lifetimes. So, it's going okay. I'm here.
You say it's getting harder than ever before. I mean, it's been a bull market now for how many years? And why is it harder now? Is it because of the low risk environment, or?
Well, maybe the biggest factor for short sellers is, and the most overlooked, is actually passive investing. And this is something I only really came to understand early this year. The effect that passive investing has on stock prices. And I previously assumed it was some kind of linear effect and it wasn't that great a slope. But what I've learned actually, and when you step back and think about this, you know, when passive buys, it pulls an active holder out of the float and replaces it with passive. So your supply of stock ends up shrinking. And when you have names that are in indices that get a lot of flows through the index funds, that creates this convex upward effect on prices. So I think that's been, you know, look, that's arguably the number one factor that's made it so hard to short in the past at least half decade. But obviously the low rate environment, the fact that companies can extend and pretend, it has made it extremely difficult. The lack of enforcement that we've seen coming out of the global financial crisis, you know, that's not awesome for short sellers. So it's been a very difficult period. And like I said, I mean, these are evolutionary pressures. You either adapt or you die off. And so far we've adapted and, you know, hopefully continue to adapt.
What strikes me about you, Carson, is that you're very evangelical almost about markets and the morality involved in capitalism. And you've said that a few times. And it just seems, why keep at it? It's so high risk. You're getting attacked by regulators. You get attacked by executives. The market storms higher and higher. And like all the things that you're talking about with passive investing, why stick with it? Aren't there easier ways to make money?
Well, there definitely are easier ways to make money. I mean, that's a given. And I'm obviously not averse to making money, right? I am a capitalist, but I've come to know reasonable number of billionaires and, you know, people are nine figures and, you know, much lower. And, you know, I think when you're in business, or investing is a business, you basically have to figure out where on the continuum you are. And, I think people who are billionaires, and I'm not, I really don't want this to come off as like, I'm saying something, I'm passing judgment on them. I think that they are very pragmatic, right? Like they treat everything as a business and they're just very, you know, they're, I don't want to say, yeah, that's the wrong adjective, but they're very clear-headed and pragmatic in their decision-making. And then, you know, I'm not over there. You know, I would love to have more money. I mean, who wouldn't, you know, cue the Sally Struthers voice, but I also want to do it in a way that I'm really comfortable with. And, you know, for me, it's, you know, like I'm okay where I am. Like I do all right, but when things work out, it gives me a sense of accomplishment. It's just a sense of accomplishment I don't think I would get on the long side. Now, that said, we are looking to do some, we're going to be looking to open an office in Vietnam early next year. And that's going to be for long side investing to really take advantage of a redirection of FDI flows away from China. So that really fits well with the long held, you know, decade and a half plus thesis I've had that China is not what the rest of the world thinks it is. And it's a malign influence in many ways and has too much leverage over us geopolitically, economically, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, like, and it, you know, and that has its own rewards in terms of, you know, intellectual rewards, looking at these companies in Vietnam and thinking about what makes sense. But yeah, I mean, what gets me out of bed, I think, will always be the prospect of finding something that's wrong that others apparently don't know about and telling the world.
Interesting. So what, I mean, with a Barron's audience, especially in mind, I've seen press reports where you've advised pension funds to stay away from investments in China. And then you mentioned some of the problems with China. That's really interesting. I want to talk more about the long only in Vietnam, by the way, but how do non-institutional investors play these markets when it comes to China, when it comes to fraud and the challenges you're talking about?
Wow. Well, look, I was screaming into the abyss for many years on China. I guess if I rewind, when I first started doing this, 2010 through 2012, just China-based issuers that were all frauds. And at that point, it seemed like at that point something changed. You know, suddenly China was uninvestable, and most of the companies from China that were listed in the U.S. went dark and were delisted, or you know, or they just really stopped, you know, pumping their stocks. But then an interesting thing happened, you know, and this is an example of, it's unfortunate. I hate to say this, I hate to really believe this as an American, but our enemies really seem to know us far better than we know ourselves. And in this respect, when it economically, I do think of the Chinese Communist Party as, you know, not an enemy, but certainly adverse to the U.S. And, you know, they, at that point in time, 2012, state-owned banks began financing leveraged buyouts of a number of these frauds. I mean, companies that were abject zeros. So U.S., you know, shareholders got paid real premia on these companies and memories were wiped. So 2014, Alibaba listed, everybody wanted a piece of Baba. Nobody cared about the voices who were saying like, wait a second, these financials seem like they're, you know, they can't be correct. Nobody cared. And from, you know, basically 2014 until very recently, nobody cared. And in early 2018, you know, I was kind of preaching the gospel, saying, you know, if you look at the U.S.-China relationship, I mean, it's starting to, you know, metaphorically take on water in almost every aspect, major aspect in which the two countries interface. And, you know, foreign direct investors in China were actually speaking their minds publicly about how, you know, they've been treated, in their views, unfairly in China. The only dry ground was public markets and this idea that Western capital, particularly U.S. capital, would invest in public China equities. And I was making the point that I don't think this can persist, and it certainly shouldn't persist because there's been so much abuse, you know, so much, I mean, fraud committed. I think a lot of stock manipulation committed, probably a lot of stock watering committed. Nobody's been able to be held accountable in China by the U.S. And that's actually codified in China's law now. It's securities law. So I've, you know, I've been warning that these chickens will come home to roost someday. And yeah, I think they have finally come home to roost. And it was a, you know, it's a bizarre combination of events. I mean, you know, it's kind of like, you know, you go bankrupt gradually and then all of a sudden. There was Luckin Coffee, which, you know, we had like a hand in. We published somebody else's research on that. And it was funny talking to a lot of media, you know, a lot of journalists, you know, who are now, you know, or cover, you know, in the financial space. So many of them were saying, wow, what an amazing story, Luckin. Like, no, like this is an old story. Like this is old, old, old. What's new is how there was this memory wipe. So there was Luckin, then there was COVID. And Trump realized that he was having re-election problems because of COVID. And fought, you know, in the wake of Luckin, he really decided to take, the administration really decided to push proposal that Senator Rubio had put forth that became the Holding Foreign Companies Accountable Act. And that was enacted unanimously by each house, or was passed unanimously by each house in December of last year. And I don't watch this stuff that closely, but I can't think of any other legislation in recent years that had unanimous support in each house. And so, of course, President Trump signed it into law. But it was really a kid glove treatment here. It gave China 3 years to allow PCAOB inspections. And I always thought that China would give on that because there are just too many government officials who have too much of their personal wealth, you know, undisclosed, obviously, or undeclared, tied up in these companies listed in the U.S. But, you know, the political situation between the U.S. and China is such that Xi would rather, I think, say, hey, look, we don't need their capital. We don't need their markets. And I think he started a process where he's basically said to these Chinese companies listed in the U.S., you got to think of, you know, something else, because by the time the SEC is permitted to begin delisting, I think Xi wants substantially all China companies already off the U.S. exchanges. So that's kind of, you know, the final catalyst. So, I mean, I think, and maybe I'm wrong, but I think we're in the end game here for U.S.-China listing. So, you know, like I said, it's one of those things. It was very, very gradual, and then looks like all of a sudden. And I could be wrong. I mean, reading tea leaves of the Chinese government is, you know, it sucks to try to do. But the last thing I would do is listen to people who say, oh, well, you know, I know people in Beijing, and this is what they're saying. Because the Chinese government has always been wonderful at feeding, like, misinformation to foreigners through those channels of the guys who like have Guanxi and, you know, have dinners and, you know, with these guys, with the senior government officials. So I'd be careful about that.
Carson, I'm going to go to our audience who has a few questions on China. So I'm going to go to Lorenz, Kate, and Michelle. Lorenz says, which area of the market represents the most fertile ground for fraud shorts today? I'm going to guess you're going to say China.
So China is a developing market. Okay. And so it's not that I necessarily pick on China. But China is unique because it's this combination of developing market and enormous amounts of capital that have been thrown at it. So I'm sure there are lots of, you know, bad situations in Brazil and lots of other markets that there, you know, a lot of fraud endemic in the developing world. You just don't see the kinds of, you know, you need to short, you need, you know, some sophistication in the capital markets so you can borrow stock, you need liquidity, you know, so you, that kind of implies market cap. China is really the only place where you get all of those things in spades. So fraud, liquidity, and borrow.
So Kate asks, what's your stop limit point for shorting China?
I mean, we don't have a macro short on China. So we've always been very much name by name. And I've been as surprised by anybody as to what's happened in terms of, like I said, what I think is a policy reversal by China. So, you know, there's this argument that I've had smart people make to me recently that, you know, there's a price for everything and there's a price at which these companies have to be longs. But, you know, there's also the George Soros FT op-ed a week or two ago, which I really agree with. And that is, you just, if you think that you're going to get bailed out because China needs foreign capital, you're wrong. You know, I hate to be completely non-committal, but on this, I just don't know. You know, but I think right now, when we look at China names now, we feel like there's much more of a tailwind in shorting them than there has been. You know, it was hard up until Luckin. Then when Luckin went down, there was a little bit of a tailwind. But then there were, you know, Bill Huang was in there like pushing stocks up. Some funds in Hong Kong were in there pushing stocks up. And it kind of became hard again. And, you know, you also had this, you had a significant portion of the hedge fund complex, you know, it's based in the US, that also wanted to preserve that market because, you know, while these guys 10 years ago were shorting all these China names, and this is what I talk about, you know, when I talk about the pragmatism of billionaires, right? Like the same guys who were short Sinoforest in massive size and these other China names are now like super long China names because, yeah, I mean, I'm sure they know they're frauds, but they don't care. It's a way to make money. So we were fighting that, you know, that support the whole time. But now maybe finally those pillars have crumbled away. And, you know, and now maybe there's a great tailwind for shorting China names, at least in the way we do it as activist short sellers. We'll see. You know, we've got a couple on the board and maybe they'll come to fruition here and then we'll test this theory.
I want to get to a lot of these audience questions. You mentioned Alibaba. I'm assuming you're bearish on that, but what are your views on Tencent? That's from Michelle.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, I guess I want to distinguish, and this maybe is so equivocal, it sounds like a complete cop-out, but I want to distinguish between being bearish and knowing that there's a problem with the financials. Okay, so like that's the Alibaba conundrum that, you know, and like that when I look at Tesla, you know, like I can't, you know, I wrote a few weeks ago that I don't know, maybe it goes down, but I just don't think that it's a great short, even though I don't think the economics of the business, you know, are like remotely, you know, like remotely good. So there's a difference, right? And the reality was we never shorted Alibaba because we figured it would go up, even though we believed the, you know, people who've done research and, you know, shown that there was a lot of, you know, fraud or that there, you know, that the financials were fraudulent. So we believe they're fraudulent. We just didn't think it mattered because one of the dynamics you have to keep in mind when it comes to China, and this is something that really bit us on our Anta short several years ago, you know, where we just kind of lost sight of this. You get these top-down allocation decisions, right? So these huge pools of capital where they say, okay, you know, we want 3% got to be in China equities or 5%, whatever it is. And so then, okay, then it gets down to the managers who are actually going to allocate it into China equities. Well, you need stuff that's large and liquid. So, you know, you cross a bunch of names off the list. Then you say, well, we don't want banks. We don't want state-owned enterprises. So then you're left with this pool of that's not really, really that big. And I think that's always been the issue with Alibaba. You know, I mean, we've had some questions internally over the years about Tencent. I mean, we haven't looked at Tencent itself closely, but we've looked at businesses that were in fields where Tencent had acquired businesses. And, you know, it kind of led us to feel like, like what Tencent's saying about XYZ, you know, business it acquired is not true. My view is that if there's no penalty for lying and there's upside for lying, then people are going to lie. And, you know, if you want to be maybe a little bit more forgiving about this when it comes to China, you know, and, oh, Pony Ma is such a great guy, why would he? Well, you know, they're all competing for capital. And if it's like cycling, right? You know, if steroids were endemic in cycling, so everybody who wasn't on steroids, if they wanted to compete, pretty much had to do steroids. And if you want to take a kinder view, you know, toward the mentality of managements in China, then just understand this. Like, most of them are cheating, if for no other reason than everybody else who's, most of the others who are competing for the same dollar, you know, or yuan, are cheating, you know, as well. So that kind of forces everybody to cheat. So I'm sure I went nowhere near answering that question, but, you know.
Well, let's go to the best way to enter short positions. That's from Marvin. I mean, you talked about liquidity or just liquidity in the short. What else?
Well,
does it to be an all-out fraud?
No, and it's funny. It's the fundamentals. So shorting frauds is a bad idea unless you're going to tell the world about it or somebody's going to tell the world about it, because they can just keep it going. And, you know, and even when you do like what we do, when we expose them, I mean, some of these companies will pull out all the stops, you know, because they get backed into a corner. And, you know, if they're concerned that what they've been doing is illegal and could potentially lead them, you know, well, maybe once upon a time they worried about, you know, going to prison. But, you know, if they feel like they have nothing to lose, then they'll fight really hard. So that's the tough thing. You don't want to be a non-activist short in a fraud. So if you're going to do non-activist shorting, which be the way most people approach it, you should probably stick to fundamentals or fundamentals-based theses. Now, you know, I think short selling is really, it's really a crappy business for a number of reasons, but you have to do a lot more research. You know, this is cliche to say, but it's true. You have to do a lot more research, especially in the fundamentals, if that's your short thesis, because you need to understand, things in a way that's better than the long side. And the long side talks to management, so they're going to get that advantage of getting, you know, like little tidbits and clues from management as to how things are going. So on the short side, you have to do a lot more work. And the problem is, if you want to avoid going out of business, which I recommend avoiding that, I mean, you really can't size your short positions larger than, you know, most cases, you know, as a non-activist short seller, 2-3% of your capital. So if you're running a fund that has, you know, a sizable short book, that implies you've got 70 to 100 short positions. And those have to each be more, I mean, they should, in theory, or somebody should have done a lot more research on them than the long side has done. And when you think about, if the bottom of your funnel is 70 or 80, the top of your funnel has got to be like some multiple of that. So I guess the first thing that I would say is how you enter short positions is, you know, everything should be size, you know, should be a small size. And if your maximum concentration is going to be 3%, maybe enter it at 2% and allow, you know, the thing to go up. And I really think that, I mean, you know, vast majority of people, I mean, if you're going to sell short, you have to be very sophisticated as an investor, but it should be as a hedge to your long book, you know? So you do not want to be, you just don't want to be short beta in today's world. We're not, and we pretty much dollar for dollar hedge everything in our short book now. And we've been doing that since, 2017 or 2018, because it's just too painful not to hedge beta.
Carson, I wanted to talk to you about fundamentals. It almost made me laugh a bit because there are some questions here on the meme stock and this short squeeze momentum. One from someone named OG. Are you tempted to ride short squeeze momentum in names where you're not short yourself? And what do you think that the short squeezes by Wall Street bets are justified? Because those weren't exactly fundamentally driven, were they?
Right. Well. Okay. So let's go to the first, GameStop, and GameStop gets to that point that I made earlier about passive, because this wasn't a case of a bunch of passive buying pushing, the stock up with GameStop. But the issue is that the real float. Okay. So, there was the nominal float, but then there was, I think, 20-25% that was held by passive, and passive will never sell unless it has outflows. And passive will continue to buy regardless of the price unless it has outflows. So every day that people are making those, contributions, the 401ks, whatever, passive is buying. So that shrank the, what seemed like the float by another, take 20-25% of the outstanding, subtract that from the float. Then you had Ryan Cohen and you had Michael Burry. And so you know that these they're going to hang on to it for a while. So your real float, like the actual supply of stock available for sale it was minuscule. And you had a sizable short position, that was many times that real, truly, true supply of available stock. And so this was identified correctly on Wall Street Bets several months before the squeeze began, one or more posters laying this case out and saying this thing could be squeezed hard just by buying out of the money calls. And if there's something that starts the stock moving upward, the delta hedging by the options market makers is going to just push it high, push it through the ceiling. And so this is technicals are the new fundamentals of the market. One of the things that we're doing, and this is a little bit of a digression, but we've just set up an entity internally. It's not for external capital. It's internal capital only. So, I don't think there should be any issue in my just mentioning this, but we named it Puppies and Rainbows LP. And so this is for us to take internal capital and do long side only. I don't even want to call it investing because I think fundamentals will be barely relevant to it, but really just us playing the long side based on technicals and fund flows. Getting back to the whole meme stock thing, that's what GameStop was about. It's the new fundamentals, it's the technicals, it's the flows, basically. And, an options market driven, tail wagging the dog. In terms of whether we chase that, no. I think that by the time, and I think this is documented, that when GameStop really went, kept going up, that was mostly institutional. I mean, the narrative was around the retailer trader who made all this money. I mean, there were some institutions that killed it doing that. But that's just not our game. I mean, that we're, as I said earlier on, we're broadening what we do. We're Vietnam thing, puppies and rainbows. We've done a little bit in the long side in junior miners. We're one for one there. That's just not a game I want to get into. I feel like that's a, maybe what we call a 55 percenter type game. The traditional 55 percenter is the fund that's playing, or the manager that's playing the quarter. And, I think they're going to beat, I think they're going to miss. And if I'm right, 55% of the time, I'm going to do very well. I don't like those games, and that's at best, you know, trying to figure out whether it keeps going up or goes down or whatever. At best, that's like a 55% game. And it's really, I think, just a coin flip. So no, we don't do that.
Carson, we don't have much time left. There are a few questions on Bitcoin and crypto, and I really wanted
to skip those because I have no opinion.
Like, oh, good.
You know, it's a coin flip, you know, will it go up? You know, I'll flip a coin, go down, whatever. It's all tulips right now, I think.
Okay.
You know, but we can skip those.
What about SPACs? I definitely wanted to get your idea on that. And I know that you've been active on Twitter against a certain SPAC proponent. I just wanted to get your overall take on the phenomenon. And I know that it's winding down a bit, or at least it seems to be for now. But what do you think?
Well, like, it was, you know, previously a way for really crap microcap companies to go public. And then, you know, as market caps exploded, you know, the more institutional players in the market on the buy side and sell side looked around and said, oh, wow, like, you know, if we try to legitimize this, we can make some serious money here. And maybe it wouldn't have been that horrific absent COVID. But when COVID hit and all of the speculative money flooded into the market, there were all these SPAC IPOs. So all of the previously IPO'd SPAC sponsors, you know, said, I mean, look, this is just a phenomenon that I've seen so often in my lifetime because I graduated into the internet bubble. And so much of my lifetime has been about too much money chasing too few good investments. And so bubbles are blown. So when you look at that dynamic, if you in, you know, 2018, 2019, listed a SPAC, it was probably going to acquire like a piece of shit anyway. But now all of a sudden you've got this massive competition and you either buy something or you give the money back. And the reality is the more you pay for something, like if you overpay for it, your 20% is actually worth more if you can just convince people that you didn't overpay for it long enough for you to sell it. So like the incentives are all wrong. The incentive is to do something versus nothing. So acquire anything versus nothing. You get all this free money and you're better off overpaying massively than you are getting it at, getting it a good value because I don't know. It seems like most of these guys, including Chamath, don't really like to hang on to their promotes that long. So, you know, like when he buys something, I mean, if he's got a, you know, if it's a decent company, he's probably going to greatly overpay for it because he's convincing the shareholders of the company, you know, to go public, which entails, you know, there's a lot of, you know, there are a lot of hassles with being public. So he's probably going to overpay and that works great for him if he, you know, is able to get out of his stock quickly. So it's just the incentives are all messed up. And the final thing is, and it's been well chronicled, but unlike IPOs where you can't really give projections because that's conditioning the market, with SPACs, because SPACs are treated like the acquisition of an operating business. So Microsoft buys LinkedIn. Like, okay, we'd love to hear Microsoft talk about why you're doing it and kind of where you think this is going to take the business. That's legitimate. I mean, that's pro-transparency. But legally, this has been treated the same way. So you have, you know, a SPAC that has nothing and it's acquiring a purported operating business, and they can just basically they can basically just make stuff up because if you don't have an email of, you know, them saying, ha ha ha, let's just make this number up, there's no way we'll ever hit it, anybody who believes this is totally stupid, ha ha ha, unless you have that, you can't prove scienter or bad faith. So I think they, you know, so basically they get away with it. Now, the SEC has made noises saying, well, you know, the safe harbor provision doesn't actually protect you from, you know, the regulatory claims that we could bring, only private claims. We'll see. I mean, the courts, unfortunately, have not been favorably disposed to the SEC in recent years. So, you know, and the SEC actually probably has a decent bit to lose by trying to enforce something that's like, you know, legally like a gray area here. I'd like to see them do that. I mean, the bottom line, like governments need to take on more hard cases and and risk the losses. But if the SEC took a case like that based on, you know, safe harbor statement does not give you, you know, immunity here to, you know, make fantastical projections, and it lost, that would basically codify that you can say whatever you want as, you know, as a SPAC that's about to de-SPAC, and there's really no legal liability. So probably more than you ever wanted to know about my view on SPACs, but, you know, it's trying to give you a little bit of, you know, form to the stream of consciousness there.
Carson, I think we have to wind it up. I do want one last question, unless there's anything you wanted to say, but it's from Leon. He says, do you see a major correction coming soon?
I've been seeing a major correction, you know, since 2011. So don't listen to me. Look, I think, so once again, you know, like what the past, you know, 12 years have taught me is to be completely equivocal in those things. But the thing that I'd say is when you think about that dynamic of passive and how it's, you know, it's just relentlessly pushing up, you know, so many of these equities, especially the ones in indexes, and really the driving force there are these target date funds, you know, so the 401ks. Whether the, you know, when those fund flows reverse, I mean, and I have no view as to whether that's this year or, you know, whatever, the market is extremely fragile because you've taken so many active managers out of the market. So when those, you know, when the flows reverse and passive is selling, it's selling at any price. And there just aren't enough active managers left to really cushion those falls. So maybe it's become like a seven sigma event that the market will sell off, but the results when it does will probably be a much larger, much faster crash than has been seen. So, you know, that's the one thing. And how do you protect from that? I don't know. I mean, you just don't want to be, you know, try not to be the one holding the bag, bottom line.
Carson, I think that's all the time we have for today, unless there was something you wanted to close off with.
No, I think that's good. Enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. Thanks for being here. And thanks for the audience for tuning in. We hope you listen to our next episode tomorrow. Market Watch reporter Alessandra Melito will be speaking with Ari Parker, lead advisor at Chapter, about Medicare, the misconceptions about the program, the best tips when planning for coverage, and what to know about the stability of the program. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and have a good day. Thanks, Carson.
Thank you.